You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 3rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Edward Miller, professor at Northeastern University, author of Nut Country, Right Wing Dallas, and the Birth of the Southern Strategy. Also on the program today, a famed New York City charter organization apparently has got-to-go lists. In other words, they're kicking out kids from their schools who are difficult to handle. That's the recipe for success in these charters. Also on the program today, new polls out. Ben Carson is up. Hillary Clinton is up. And apparently, Marco Rubio is surging. If you have a very, very low bar for the term surge. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Lawrence Lessig drops out of the race. Bernie Sanders meets with Joe Biden and also, unrelated, calls for an end to the death penalty. Back to the Republicans, Debategate. In full effect. So much so that President Obama actually has dipped into, this is unconfirmed, dipped into my Twitter feed to mock Republicans. Meanwhile, turns out Ted Cruz's super PACs are super grifts. He may be getting ripped off by his own super PACs, ladies and gentlemen. Marco Rubio has a couple of new billionaires apparently sponsoring him. No word on whether or not he'll wear their labels on his jacket. And TransCanada asked the Obama administration to pause their hearings on, or I should say their deliberations on Keystone XL going forward. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot of house cleaning to do. First off, I guess I should make you aware of the fact that it is the case on, I guess it was on Thursday or Friday, we announced that if there were enough members or new members who either added their name to supporting this program by becoming a member or upgraded their membership, we would then, in the members podcast, cut out, not all of it, because sometimes I talk over it, but we will not run La Poupée through the whole show. Now, we still do it live, but for the podcast, for the members podcast, ladies and gentlemen, and I don't have access to my 360, I should say my sound machine. But imagine a trumpet blaring right now. We will be shortening La Poupée. for members going forward. So there you have it. Everybody's very excited. Thank you. We got just exactly, I think it was, I don't know what the breakdown, four members upgraded and six new members, which got us right to 10. So somehow people knew exactly, just exactly where to stop joining.
They don't give us any extra.
Now, I will also add this. We spoke to Tina Dupuy, I guess it was a week or two ago, about a new podcast that she is trying to get together called Cultish. You'll recall, Tina grew up in a cult, and it messed with her head significantly. The most obvious of manifestation, the This American Life did a story about it. She thought that she was an alcoholic for the greater part of her life, and it turned out that she wasn't. Or I should say, she had been going to AA and had become literally a poster child for AA. She was in the pamphlets as one of the youngest members of AA, and it turned out that she had not really ever drank. Or she had drank once, but this was all a function of her growing up in this very sort of strange cult. She is launching a podcast about cults, and she's trying to raise some money on Kickstarter. We have a link at majority.fm. If you go there and contribute, I'm not sure how much it is. $31, I think it is. If you go there and sign up to contribute, we'll give you a free month's worth of Majority Report membership. So head over to that Kickstarter. If you want to test this show out, being a member, and you want to help her, this is the perfect time to do both those things. So check that out. This is just too funny. Part of this debate gate, and because it's really out of control. Let's listen. All right, before we do that, let me just say this. I've shaven again today, ladies and gentlemen, in anticipation of recording Ring of Fire, and with a possibility that I'll be doing MSNBC. But I just found out that that this month it's apparently Movember. Do you know what Movember is, Michael?
I actually don't.
Yeah, well, I didn't know either.
No idea.
But apparently, Movember is a month out of the year where guys grow mustaches to raise awareness and money for men's health issues. I'm not kidding. It's true.
Jesus Christ.
I will not be growing a mustache.
Stash for the prostate?
Yeah.
Nah.
I will not be doing that.
All right.
But apparently, Harry's is the official razor partner of Movember so that you can sort of shape your mustache. I'm not going to grow a mustache.
Have you ever had one?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. In fact, you can find them online. I had a mustache, for a while back in, prior to the Break Room Live days.
What a disaster.
When I was living upstate. No, it looked great. It looked great. It freaked out Milo. But now I shave all the time. And, folks by now know that I shave with Harry's blades. They're the best. They're super sharp. They provide a close and a comfortable shave, and they do it for an incredible price. And the thing is, getting started with Harry's, it cannot be easier. Even someone with Michael's internet skills. I mean, you're good at posting stuff on LinkedIn, but I'm saying actually, right, like interacting with a website. You get it's an amazing deal, the starter set. I've told you about it before. You get a razor handle, a nice one, a chrome one. You get three blades and your choice of shaving cream or, you know, the frothy kind. What is that? Shaving foam. And you get it, if it's your first time getting Harry's, for $10. For everybody else, it's $15, which is still an amazing deal. They also give 1% of their sales and 1% of their time back to the communities they serve. They sell his products at factory direct prices, so they only cost a fraction of the big brands. So again, you get a razor handle, three blade cartridges, and your choice of shaving cream or foaming shave gel delivered to your door. Shipping's free. Go to harrys.com right now. And for Majority Report listeners, you'll get $5 off your first order with the code Majority Report. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com, coupon code Majority Report. Let's listen to President Obama speaking at a fundraiser in New York City last night, about the Republicans not being able to handle CNBC questions.
Have you noticed that every one of these candidates say, Obama's weak. Putin's kicking sand in his face. When I talk to Putin, he's going to straighten out. Just looking at him, he's going to be. And then it turns out they can't handle a bunch of CNBC moderators. I mean, let me tell you, if you can't handle those guys, then I don't think the Chinese and the Russians are going to be too worried about you.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Barack Obama in NYC last night. And not for nothing, that was on November 2nd. And here is my Twitter feed at 6:40 p.m. November 1st. Of course, the real untold story is how the GOP whining about CNBC has empowered Putin. He sees this kind of crap and just laughs. And so there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Barack Obama obviously dipping into my Twitter feed.
Yeah, I was scrolling it. Not too bad for a failed out comedian. Occasionally you wheel one out there.
There you go.
Yeah, no, I was impressed. Sam, I also dipped into your thoughts on Medicare and Social Security. I was like, I don't need to cut that.
Boom.
Total insight.
There you go.
You ever think about embracing Islam, Sam?
I have not.
A whole new sense of peace and direction to your troubled and irritated life.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, President Obama.
You got to think about it.
Just one more note. Today's show is sponsored by Howl.fm. It's a brand new app and website that changes the way you think about podcasts. With Howl Premium, you get exclusive access to dozens of original miniseries, audio documentaries, and comedy albums, all the archives from WTF with Marc Maron, and all the Earwolf shows like Comedy Bang Bang or How Did This Get Made? And the Howl originals are truly unique. One of the Howl original shows that I would recommend to the listeners for the Majority Report is the new audio documentary, Something Cool. It's an audio documentary series that focuses on brilliant careers of relatively underrated yet crucial artists who deserve to have their fascinating stories told. The first episode is about Bobby Gentry. She was the first, if I'm not mistaken, the first country music star who was a woman who wrote and produced her and sang her own songs. So I would check that out. You can get access to all this exclusive content on your iPhone, your Android phone, and the web for only $5 a month. And with the promo code MAJORITY, you get a full month of free trial. So to redeem your promo code, make sure you create your account at on the web at howl.fm. Enter the code MAJORITY at checkout. That's Howl, HOWL.FM. Use the promo code MAJORITY for 1 month free trial of Howl Premium. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Edward Miller on Nut Country, Right Wing Dallas, and the Birth of the Southern Strategy.
Alone, is there a ghost in my house?
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Edward Miller. He is an assistant teaching professor at Northeastern University Global and author of Nut Country, Right Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy. Ted, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to have this opportunity to talk about the book.
So, all right, let's talk about this. You know, I found this fascinating because from my sort of, I guess, understanding and, you know, I always had sort of assumed that the Southern Strategy was developed after the passage of the 1965 Civil Rights Act. And your book basically argues that, in fact, the Southern Strategy was developed years before that in Texas.
Well, that's correct. That's our straw man, and that's what we're trying to blow down. And just to give you a little background on the Southern Strategy, in the late 1950s, the vast majority of Southerners, they loathe the Republican Party because of its historical legacy as the party of Lincoln. Southerners wanted no part of a party that had been established in 1854 for the purposes of promoting non-slave labor and stopping the spread of slavery into the American West. And the traditional narrative is that the Republican leaders like Barry Goldwater, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, they broke the Democratic Party's hegemony in the solid South and segments of the North by capitalizing on the reactions of white voters to events in the 1960s. The counterculture, the decline of traditional sex mores, the decrease in union membership, the new tendency of whites to see themselves as homeowners, taxpayers, and school parents rather than workers. And those are the kind of things that were shaping their political thinking. But even more crucial, the Democratic Party's support for affirmative action, school busing, welfare, made Northern as well as Southern white voters conclude that the party really no longer protected their interests, but protected those of African Americans. And in order to attract these disaffected voters into the GOP, it was politicians like Goldwater, Nixon, Reagan, they developed a Southern strategy, as you said, at framing a colorblind discourse of rights, freedom, individualism, small government, appealing to the values of middle-class suburbanites. Now, in the background, Republican colorblind conservatism, it predominantly appealed to class advantage, economic rights, but race always hovered in the equation. Now, as you said, this book is different. This book challenges this traditional narrative and says that the GOP's Southern strategy is born not in the 1960s, not as a response to what's going on with the counterculture and other issues, but in the 1950s Southwest. And it was, in fact, explicitly racial in motivation and application. And I argue in this book that it's Dallas Republicans who were blazing the trail for the GOP by making racial appeals to white Democrats as early as 1956. That's what I found.
So let's talk about that because, I guess we should start with and then circle back around to guys like Alger and Criswell and Howard Hunt. But we should start with just the title, Nut Country. Where did that come from?
Yeah. Well, Nut Country is actually it's an idle remark that was made in a Fort Worth hotel room, rather prophetically, by the President of the United States, JFK, on November 22nd, 1963. He said to his wife, Jackie, that we're entering Nut Country today. It was in a reference to what was included in a newspaper that was derived from Ted Dealey, who was one of the anti-communist and ultra-conservative editors of the Dallas Morning News. And JFK was responding to what he would consider a unfavorable climate from the right. But actually, as it turns out, ironically, he's killed by somebody from the left. So in a complicated way, he was correct.
Yeah, I mean,
so
that's
the origin of it.
And by the left, you mean Oswald as having identified as a Marxist?
I definitely conclude in this book on many occasions that I believe that Oswald was the assassin on November 22nd, and there was only one assassin. I think that we're at that point. I think where we can say that's the definitive. It's case closed. I think it's time to close that case.
All right. Well, I mean, leaving that aside.
Okay, sure. I know it'll be a continued discussion for years. So
indeed, and I don't want to get I'm most interested in the sort of the development of this strategy. Like, how did it? Where was it? You know, and in many respects, I mean, it seems to me, right? There's got to be. For every story like this of an attempted strategy or a moment that ultimately is found to be successful, right? There's probably dozens of stories in different cities around or states around the country where a politician responds to a phenomenon that's going on and it doesn't work. And so that's where it ends, right? I mean, so that and so.
Yeah.
But so tell us how in Dallas or in Texas around the Dallas area, how it is that a politician comes to find like this could be a successful way to run.
Yeah. Well, it was Bruce Alger, and it was a campaign in 1956 that was the original application of the Southern strategy that. That grew into a national strategy of the by the Republican Party. He was a Dallas Republican elected to Congress in 1954. He was followed by John Tower, who was Texas's first Republican senator since Reconstruction. He served from 61 to 1985. A number of other people would follow this, but it's originally Alger's campaign. His reelection campaign, in which he made it very clear to African Americans that the Republican Party was not sympathetic to their cause. His 1956 reelection campaign is an important precedent, an important moment for the racialization and really the future Southern strategy of the Republican Party. It marks the first time that a Southern Republican had abandoned a measured stance on integration. Alger was a gradualist on integration before this election, and he began to embrace segregationist positions to continue to be elected, to continue to build his electoral coalition. He made the boldly and baldly political decision to make it very clear to white voters that he was antagonistic towards the interests of civil rights and blacks. And Tower would do the same thing. Now, Tower had talked about getting rid of the perception of the Texas Republican Party as the party of Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner, who were famous radical Republicans who supported black rights in Reconstruction. Now, Tower, he piggybacks what Alger does. Tower is a fascinating figure. He introduces himself every time he says, "I'm Tower, but I do not." He was only about 5 foot. He was only about 5 foot three, but he's a little known professor of political science. He runs for the U.S. Senate from Texas first in 1960, and then he runs again in 1961. He wins in a special election, and with his victory, he became the first Republican senator from Texas since Reconstruction. And then he completely embraced Alger's ultra-conservative stance on race.
Well, let's before we get before we go any further with Tower, and I, you know, I think some of our listeners around my age and older will remember that Tower's career basically ended, I think, in a failed nomination for Secretary of Defense, if I'm not mistaken, because apparently the Senate decided at that moment they didn't like senators who drank, which seemed a little bit odd. But so Alger, what was it? I mean, and you describe in the book Alger as a guy who's basically this was completely, or I don't know, maybe completely, but it sounds almost wholesale a decision that could have just as easily been like, oh, people are for the the Civic Center project, then I'm going to come out for Civic Center project. Like, he was led by the people. And where was it? What leader? I mean, I guess I'm sort of trying to lean towards Criswell and the sort of what drove Alger? What provided him this sort of like what he ultimately found to be a solution?
Well, you hit the nail right on the head. It's Criswell who forces Alger to move to the right on race. It's the constituents who follow Criswell.
And tell people who Criswell is.
Now, Criswell is the reverend of the First Baptist Church in Dallas. It's the largest Baptist church in Texas. Criswell is Billy Graham's pastor. He's also H.L. Hunt's pastor. H.L. Hunt is the richest man in the world and a Dallas resident. But Criswell is a segregationist. And there's an incident in South Carolina in which Criswell said some terrible things against integration. Just he went completely over the top against integration. And what happened was this spurred a renewed drive for the spiritual defense of segregation. In other words, using the Bible to back up segregation. And I found in numerous op-eds in the Dallas Morning News, Dallas citizens backing up what Criswell had to say, as well as what Carrie Daniel, who came up with another pamphlet supporting the spiritual defense of segregation, said. Many, many constituents were saying that the Bible said that integration was wrong. You can see it in all the papers of the Dallas Morning News, that people are becoming very interested in how Criswell and a number of other ministers are using the Bible to support the continuance of segregation. Now, in this environment, there's another incident in Mansfield, Texas, in which there's an attempted integration of the high school there. There's a lot of support for the spiritual defense of segregation to stop that integration. In this environment, it becomes very, very difficult for Alger to navigate in. I mean, he's a Republican in the South. Very difficult to find a Republican in the South. He has only been a representative for 2 years, and he has a lot of his constituency that begins to ape what Criswell is saying and what a popular pamphlet, and that's the Carrie Daniel, God the Original Segregationist pamphlet that was reproduced in the Dallas Morning News, saying that the Bible supports the segregation of the races. Alger makes a political decision to abandon his gradualist position on integration and move to the right. By the early 1960s, he's known in the Dallas Morning News as the biggest supporter of Robert E. Lee among all the representatives in Texas. It's a complete change of heart. And I think it has a
change
lot to do
heart?
With Criswell.
I mean, you know, I mean, that's, I mean, this is a guy, I mean, it's, I mean, it, on some level, I mean, it, this, this.
A political decision,
right.
But at the same time, it is a political decision. But the people are driving, this political decision. So it is, as far as we know it, I don't know his
right,
heart,
right,
but
right.
I can surmise that it is a political decision to do this. He wanted to continue being a congressman, and this has some serious consequences and establishes a significant precedent for the future.
And I want to talk about the precedent going forward, but and I know this is sort of maybe perhaps slightly outside of the scope of what you've worked on, but what was it? I mean, was it simply things that were going on locally? But you have the head, this guy Criswell, the head of the largest, I guess what we call today a mega church in Dallas.
Yep.
And and he starts espousing this stuff, which I guess is sort of this notion. I mean, what drove that? I mean, was that also just on his part is sort of a cynical, hey, this is the way, I'm sensing this is out there, or maybe people are coming back from the war and there's just a sense out there that we're seeing too much,
of
hints of protest. Yeah, give me a second.
Yeah, it derives direct. Yeah, go on. Excuse me.
No, go ahead.
It derives directly from the 1954 Brown decision, the landmark decision by Chief Justice Earl Warren, declaring integration of the schools. You know, it's Criswell who is responding in 1956. I mean, it's even a situation where. It's tested, the 54 Brown decision is tested in Mansfield, Texas, and there's an outcry against integrating the Mansfield High School. Even the governor of Texas, Alan Shivers, opposes it and uses language. A spiritual defense of segregation language to oppose it. So it's the Brown decision compounded with the Mansfield attempt to integrate the school.
Interesting. And
that leads to.
Let's talk a little bit about Howard Hunt, because I imagine that part of the idea that this sets a precedence. I mean, we can see these sort of like and I imagine that there are sort of other things happening simultaneously in other places throughout the country in terms of where some politicians are realizing like, hey, I can ride this wave of racism fairly effectively. But in some ways, it's a guy like Howard Hunt who is got all this huge amount of oil money and creates sort of a media empire. Maybe that's too strong of a word, but certainly a big media outlet and using this guy, Dan Smoot. Tell us about that, because that seems to me to play into how this becomes a precedent rather than just a moment in history.
That's correct. Now the precedent in the case of Hunt and Smoot is a little bit more complex, because they're not just pushing. Smoot is in particular is not just pushing a racism, but he's pushing Hunt and Smoot are pushing conspiracy theory. They're pushing absolutism. They are pushing
Smoot. You describe. It seems to me I would describe Smoot as. And this guy was a former FBI agent, apparently. But he's sort of like an Alex Jones precursor.
Yes, he's far right. He is a, as he said, an FBI. He formerly worked for J. Edgar Hoover, at least he claimed to. He had claimed to study at the Extension School at Harvard University, and he pushes a conspiratorial view of the world, and he is by far a rabid segregationist, and he's pushing apocalyptic language that we're in the end, that we're in the last stages. He is a Baptist fundamentalist, that we're in the last. He doesn't specifically say that we're in our last days, but does suggest it, but definitely suggests we're in our last. This is our last gasp of liberty, like the the Brown decision was the could be the end of America as we know it. There's a lot of conspiratorial, the ways in which he looks at the world. And Smoot is he's a very good communicator. He's a very active communicator on ultra-conservative politics and filled with these conspiracy theories. And he gets his start with Hunt because Hunt supplies the money for Smoot to be able to establish his Dan Smoot Report, which started 10 years before William F. Buckley's firing line. The Dan Smoot Report was playing in a Dallas, Texas studio in 1957. He also has a pretty extensive Dan Smoot Report. It's a written product that's sent out every month to his followers.
And in my understanding is his show continued on national television even until the Fairness Doctrine basically convinced people to drop it because they didn't want to have to add something, some equal time.
One of my, yes, it continues. The his Dan Smoot Report, I know, continues until at least 1971. He's producing a pamphlet form that continues on into 1971. It's one of the collections that I was able to acquire over the course of doing all this research is the entire Dan Smoot Report from 1957 to 1971. So
wow,
that was a find.
Well, so tell us, how does it go? I mean, walk us through this. How do we go from, to me that the Southern strategy is probably not even articulated as such at that time. And it seems to be just sort of like hanging there as a solution, or was it hanging there as a solution by the time you get to, let's say, the Civil Rights Act, or was it already beginning to propagate beyond Texas?
Well, it begins to propagate beyond Texas in the case of Goldwater, but it first has to get out of Dallas, and that's what Tower did. That's what Tower was able to do. He's elected in 1961, becomes the first Republican senator from Texas. And with the election of Tower in the U.S. Senate, it's clear that the politics of race is gradually just pushing the party of Lincoln into the arms of the segregationists. Tower is very active on the platform committee in 1960. And he's able to influence the platform committee to make a more mild civil rights plank. So he's having influence outside of Texas, even before he's a senator, he's on the platform committee. Now, when Tower attended his first meeting of the Senate's Southern Caucus, Lyndon Johnson had never attended. The caucus leader, who was arch-segregationist Richard Russell of Georgia, he returned to him and he said, "I want to welcome Texas back into the Confederacy." So there's this sense that it is spreading, but there is a possibility for the Republican Party to move to the right on race. And this continues with the an important nomination in 1962 to a gubernatorial to the governor's office. James Cox is nominated as the Republican nominee, and he reinforces the GOP's image in Texas as an anti-civil rights, pro-states party. One commenter said that Cox had my vote, one Dallasite explained, because he's the only candidate who's unalterably opposed to the despicable, vicious civil rights bill. And this continues as other Texas candidates begin to start to use race and introduce Southern strategy type language, including George H.W. Bush. Bush is one of its artisans, and he says outside Dallas in Grand Prairie, an attack against the Civil Rights Act, he says the new Civil Rights Act was passed to protect 14% of the people.
Mm.
I'm also worried about the other 86%.
This is Poppy Bush.
This is having a snowball effect.
Right.
The Poppy Bush, yes.
Fascinating. Now, and so then... Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, this is where we move it to the national level. We start to see the same people who are involved in Texas politics go national, people like Peter O'Donnell and Rita Bass, who are instrumental in getting power and power elected and getting Alger elected. But they start to move into the national level, and they become very, very active on the Barry Goldwater campaign. And I'll explain how this happens. So from the vantage point of Dallas Republicans in early 1963, it's Barry Goldwater who's the biggest and brightest hope for national conservative Republicans since Robert Taft. Peter O'Donnell, who started off as the Dallas chairman of the GOP, and then he went on to become the Texas chairman of the GOP, was wild about Barry. He was so wild about Barry that he left. He left his post in Texas in February of 1963, and he accepted the position of the chairman of the Draft Goldwater Committee, organizing its headquarters on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. And he brought some fellow Dallasites along, just solidifying the image of Dallas as the epicenter, but also continuing to move it into the national level. Rita Bass was a very important Dallas conservative, and she accepted Peter O'Donnell's invitation to join him in Washington. She became the national canvassing director. And by the time the committee held its first press conference, O'Donnell and White and F. Clifton White had already lined up Draft Goldwater chairman in 33 states.
Wow.
They had a nationwide Republican support from precinct chairman to national committee women. And we know that we know at this point that Goldwater gets the nomination. But what made Goldwater so appealing to O'Donnell was his early affinity to the Southern strategy. Now, keep in mind that in 1952, President Eisenhower got 44% of the African American vote. In 1956, he got 40%. In 1960, the nominee, Richard Nixon, got 36%. Barry Goldwater would get 6%. Of the African American vote in 1964.
And that was by design, right? I mean, he famously said, like, we're going fishing where the fish are, or something to that effect. Go ahead. Sorry.
And I'm going to get right to that. He told Atlanta Republicans that despite the fact that they got that, I mean, that's a solid amount, 36%, that we're not going to get the Negro vote, he said. So we're going to go hunting where the ducks are.
Ah.
Yeah. And with that, Goldwater headed south in search of some ducks.
And the rest, in many respects, is history, right? I mean, this becomes a much easier and obvious project after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and as it begins to sort of metastasize over the next, really, I guess, 40 or 50 years. I mean, running through Ronald Reagan visiting Philadelphia, yep. Mississippi, and through, really, I mean, in some respects, through Donald Trump.
Yeah. Goldwater, his version of the Southern strategy, he demonized the Civil Rights Act. He said it dangerously tread into private affairs of men. The second component of his strategy was the film Choice, which I would advise anybody to see. Goldwater, it's a much more explicit type of appeal. It was so racist that Goldwater prohibited using it, but it gives the fact that it was produced demonstrated that winning the South was the chief was the chief goal. And the third component is really improved by Nixon, but it's the effort to conflate civil rights and civil disorder.
Right.
Arguing that crime in the streets resulted from disrespect for authority, waning morals, which was a result of the liberalism's welfare state. I mean, that's how he applied the Southern – that's how Goldwater applied the Southern strategy.
Right, and that last part by Nixon – the last part by Nixon is sort of an add-on, if you will.
Yeah. And in fact, I found a document in 1960, well before Nixon is using, and the document's in the book. Well, but this is well before – actually, it's 1959, and it's by Maurice Carlson. It's Nixon's Maurice Carlson is the Dallas County GOP chair, and he basically says what you need to do is convince the whites that you are against the blacks because birds of a feather will stick together. And basically those words, and Nixon, it appears, wrote excellent job. And his aide said that he wanted to see more analysis of such type in the future. So Nixon knows what's going on at this stage. It is working in Texas.
Fascinating stuff. Well, Ted Miller, the book is Nut Country, Right Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, it's wonderful. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to talk about the book. And I'd be happy at any time to speak further about it.
Great.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Thank you.
I enjoyed this.
I'm glad. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. Now, tomorrow on the program, we're going to sort of follow up on this, is what is happening, not quite concurrently, but around the same time, a little bit earlier, coming out of California, where we see the fusion of big business and some other sort of conservative ideologies. And at one point, all this stuff coming from California and Texas meet, I guess, somewhere along the Mason-Dixon line, and then give us what we have today in the Republican Party. But, you know, the thing that I think is going to become clear after we talk tomorrow to Catherine Olmstead on her book Right Out of California is, you know, much of what we see today is really part of an existing lineage. And there are times where it sort of submerges, and other times where it sort of pops out of the water of history, if you will. And we're just at a time now where this strain, which has run through Republican politics really close to the past, I guess, 80 years, some of the, you know, the more ugly parts of it are just poking their heads out of the water. And it's rather amusing to watch. I mean, we'll talk about this as we head into the fun half. But we are 90 days away. 90 days. And subtract, you know, week for Thanksgiving. Subtract 2 weeks for Christmas. I mean, we're about 2.5 months, maybe less, away from the Iowa caucus. And if you go back 2.5 months from today, Donald Trump is still in the lead, right? I mean, he announces in June, and within weeks, he's at the front of this. So the idea that somehow, like, this race is going to radically change over the next 2 months, 3 months, there are some Republican establishment figures who are beginning to crap themselves and are starting to realize. And, you know, like I spoke about this on the day that Trump launched his campaign. This is going to cause a long overdue reassessment by the purveyors of conventional wisdom, the mainstream press, that, like, you know, this Republican Party is normal, you know, is fit to be around people. And, you know, we'll talk about what's going on with Ben Carson. I mean, this guy, there's a lot of, like, you know, Carson and Trump are not, it's clear, are not vying, at least in terms of the majority of their voters, are not vying. They're not fishing from the same pool, as it were. They're not hunting for the same, for the ducks in the same place. It's just that there are two strains of ducks. There's the lunatics, and then there's the religious lunatics. And that's what you basically are seeing in the Republican Party. And it's showing itself in the polls, and the desperation from the establishment is also showing itself insofar as now Marco Rubio is surging all the way up to double digits in these polls, where, you know, I don't know if he's past where Carly Fiorina was for the week and a half that she was, but, you know, hope springs eternal, I guess, for these billionaires. They need to place their money somewhere.
I could tell you about who's supporting who if you'd
well,
be interested.
In the fun half of the program, we will touch base with the Reverend Dr. Carson.
The Reverend Dr. Ben Carson.
And
Marco Rubio is a lightweight and a loser.
See, now that's the thing, Carson.
Donald Trump lines in my mouth.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will also be reading the, I guess, the hostage demands from the Republican candidates.
And Megyn Kelly,
to
actually.
To the network. What's that?
Megyn Kelly on your sound sheet actually had some funny
responses
to their demands.
We'll get into
even
this.
Even she is getting in on it.
Well, of course, they've already had their debate, so they don't. I imagine Fox gets another one, right?
Legitimately, she gave the best. I mean, the Fox debate was actually, other than it was actually the most sort of sharp edged, well conducted debate by far.
I think in many respects. But part of it was also that was when Trump was at the sort of peak Trump, and he was being attacked, and there's nothing that can sort of, like, I guess, attract voters in the Republican Party to a Republican candidate than a Republican candidate who responds with offense to the question.
Right.
Right. That is the key. It's like I'm being maligned, just like, and that's how people relate. That's how people relate. That's how the Republicans relate. You're being maligned because you just said some racial joke.
Right.
You know, so you're like.
All I said was black, like, people can't swim.
That's right.
And now I can't speak anymore.
Right. That's
my
just,
First Amendment.
That's just like it was for me at the work the other day when I made that comment about the delivery man who came up shucking and jiving. And everybody looked at me as if I was crazy. And at least Donald Trump gets it. You know, whatever. That's what's going on in the mind of a Republican voter. All right. We're going to take a break. The number 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, you call in. Folks, it's your membership that makes this show possible. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget Just Coffee, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority FM blend. If you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is to steal some money from Jeff Bezos and give it to us. At MajorityReportKickback.com. Going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.